So there was a man who was looking for a hunting dog. And he read an ad on Craigslist about a hunting dog that somebody was selling, and it said it was $2,500, but well worth it. And he called the number because he was intrigued why somebody would be charging $2,500 for this hunting dog. And the man told him that he really had to see the dog in action to understand why he was asking this high, high price for the dog. And so the next morning they went, and they went out hunting early, and the dog flushed two birds from a clump of bushes. The men took careful aim, and they bagged them both, and they fell into the water. And so the dog goes after them, and he walks on top of the water, grabs the two birds, and walked back to the men still on top of the water. So the man is amazed. He buys the dog on the spot, pays cash. I want this dog. And so the next day, he takes his brother out hunting with him because he's got to show off this amazing dog. And so he persuades his brother to go out. They once again, the dog flushes a couple of birds out. Once again, they shoot the birds. They fall into the water, and the dog walks on top of the water, retrieves the birds, and walks back to them on top of the water. And so the guy who just bought the dog is looking at his brother with this smug look on his face like, yeah, how about this? And he asked his brother what he thought of the dog, and the brother replied, so you bought a dog who can't swim. And so we're entering the Christmas season right now. We're celebrating the birth of Jesus, the Son of God, we will get back to that, who entered the world to save us from our sins. How could anyone possibly think of that as anything other than good news? This is the event that changed everything. Without Jesus being born, we couldn't be forgiven. So who could possibly not get excited about that fact? Who could view that event as anything other than the greatest event the world has ever known? Because it was the greatest event that the world has ever known. In human history, no event has superseded Jesus, the Son of God, leaving eternity, invading our timeline to come and redeem all mankind. Nothing even comes close. But the reality of perspective is that there are plenty of people who are going to view it through their own lens. How could anybody not be amazed at the dog walking on water? Well, his brother had a different perspective. Well, he can't swim. That's a problem. And some are going to celebrate Christmas. Others are going to see the dark cloud around every silver lining. And the way people view that truth are going to fall all along the spectrum in between those two extremes. Everyone is going to see the story a little bit differently based on their own experiences and their own vantage point. For some, Christmas is the happiest, the most wonderful time of the year. For others, Christmas is tainted with some sadness because they lost a loved one around that time, and it's always a memory that they will go through. There's perspective into the season, and where they're standing in life when they encounter the truth will affect it. Stories told of three blind men who encounter an elephant for the first time. And so each of these three blind men are trying to describe what an elephant is like because they've never seen one, but obviously because they're blind. But they come in contact with a different part of the animal. So the one who grabbed the tusk of the elephant describes the elephant as being like a spear. The one who encountered the massive body said the elephant is like a wall. The one who grabbed hold of the tail said the elephant is like a rope. So all of them had a different perspective on what an elephant was like. None of them had a complete picture. They were all slaves to their own perspective. And each week in this series, we're going to take a look at this miraculous event, the birth of Jesus, through the eyes of one of the main characters in the story, to see it from their perspective and to see what we can learn from them. Because the reality is there's a little bit of Herod, a little bit of the shepherds, Mary and Joseph, the innkeeper. There's a little bit of all these main players in the story in each one of us. We can relate in some way to where they're at when they encounter the truth, and we can relate to their perspective and we can learn from it. And as we look at the story from their perspective, I think we're going to go deeper about the truth of the moment when God invaded our timeline with his love. So that's the goal with this series throughout the month of December. So let's kick it off today with the man we know as Herod. Now, surely the leader of the Jewish people is going to be excited about the arrival of the Messiah, right? I mean, he's got to be excited. And in order to understand Herod's perspective, we need to go back a little bit on his journey and how he got to where he is. So we're going to do a little bit of the life and times of Herod the Great to see what his story looked like. So let's start there. The year is now 47 BC, and Herod the Great is only 25 years old. He has just been named the governor of Galilee, which is a high, high position for a man of his age. The Romans hope that Herod can pacify the Jews and stop them from causing problems. They hope that he's the one who can just make them go away. And he does, sort of. First, he captures the bandit leader Ezekias and executes him. So this guy's been causing all sorts of problems. He captures him, executes him, and earns the admiration of all the Roman leaders in the area for his thoroughness and his ruthlessness. Next, he marries into the leading Jewish family, the Hasmoneans. And over the next 4 to 5 years, civil war and infighting erupt inside the Roman leadership ranks, and Herod keeps positioning himself with those who he knows are going to come out on top. So he aligns himself with the winner each and every time and continues to gain favor with Rome. Now in 40 BC, the Roman Senate gives him the title and rank of King of the Jews. And it was a title the Jews hated because he was not even a Jew by birth. He was a Roman citizen. He had no connection to the kingship line of David. And he wasn't even a practicing Jew by religion. He just wanted to rule over them. And yet Rome granted him the title King of the Jews. So as the years roll on, Herod now proves to be a wickedly clever and cruel man. Like most dictators, he holds on to the reins of power very, very tightly, and he is not doesn't take well to anybody trying to loosen his grip, and he brutally removes anyone who gets in his way. And over the years, he killed many, many people, including his brother-in-law. He killed his mother-in-law. He killed his wife, and he killed 3 of his own sons, all to preserve his power. It was the murder of his wife that pushed him over the edge and drove him mad. He killed her because he thought she was a threat to his power, but he never got over her and he never got over what he did. Even though he was only 44 when he killed her, and even though he lived to be 70, her murder was the beginning of the end for Herod. You see, above everything else, Herod the Great was a killer. That's who he was. That was his nature. He killed out of spite. He killed to stay in power. Sometimes he killed just because. Human life meant nothing to him, and the historian Josephus called him barbaric. Another writer dubbed him the malevolent maniac. The man was not well-liked. Perhaps his basic character can best be seen by one incident a few years before the birth of Jesus. Herod is now an old, old man. He has been in power for 41 years. So he's now in his 60s, which is the equivalent of 90, 100, 110 for us. I mean, that is really, really old for him to be in his 60s at this time in history. And word comes that his, I'm sorry, my mom reacted when I said 60s was really old. Historically placing it, okay? Context there, Mom, sorry. but word comes to Herod at this point that his sons are plotting to overthrow him and remove him from power. They are his sons from his late wife, Mariamne, and he orders them put to death by strangling. Caesar Augustus, who's one of the rulers of the time period, very famous Roman leader, says it is safer to be Herod's sow than his son because he has no regard for human life. His wife, his mother-in-law, his brother-in-law, 3 sons, among hundreds of others, killing is what Herod did best. So now we're 2 to 3 years later. Herod the Great, King of the Jews, is slowly dying. He is at end of life. And the way Josephus describes his disease leads us to believe that it was degenerative, that it was very painful. His body is racked with convulsions. His breath comes very painfully, his skin covered with sores. He is rapidly losing his mind, but he is still the king. Rome has not withdrawn his power. And one day word comes to him in Jerusalem that some visitors have arrived from the east. Strange men with a strange question for him. They are magi, the wise men from the East. They were priests of an Eastern religion who practiced astrology. They studied signs in the heavens to see what great events were transpiring. In Persia, they were considered powerful men. They had journeyed across the desert seeking an interview with Herod. The important thing to Herod was not who they were. The important thing to Herod was what they asked. In Matthew 2, verse 2, it says, this is the question they had. Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. There are a lot of unanswered questions about this verse. Who precisely are these wise men? We have no idea. Where did they come from? We don't know the answer to that either. What was this star they saw in the sky? Nope, don't have an answer for that one either. All we know is this happened. Herod didn't know the answers either, but he knew he'd better find out what this was all about because somebody is being given his title, according to these wise men. He's the king of the Jews, not whomever they are referring to. And so they were looking for someone born king of the Jews. How could that be? Herod was the king of the Jews. He was not born that way. He had to fight and kill to gain that title that he was given. So what were these men talking about? Someone who was born with the birthright to be king of the Jews. Even at the end of his life, his concern was not for his kingdom, not for his succession, who he was going to transfer his power to leave things in good hands. It was to cling desperately to the power base that he had, and he had excruciatingly built up over time. Even at the end, he did not want to let go. So this is it. God steps into human history and intersects our timeline with his love. And how does Herod react? He sends the Magi to Bethlehem to scout out and return to him, planning to kill the baby before anything can happen to threaten his power. He responded just like he always has. And instead, the Magi encounter Jesus, and they are so taken with this baby and the miraculous nature of him that they worship him. And they are warned by God not to go back to Herod, and so they return to their country by another way and avoid going back to Herod. And at this point, Herod completely loses it. He gives the order for every child under 2 years old in Bethlehem and the surrounding areas to be executed immediately. Herod died just a few years later. Herod's perspective on the Christmas story is quite different than most. But there are some things that influenced his perspective that could easily influence ours as well if we're not careful. So I want to just go over a few thoughts today on how Herod reacted to the presence of Jesus that I want us to look at and learn from this morning. And the first thing that we can gain from Herod's perspective into this story is this. You will never find Jesus if you don't go looking for him. You will never find Jesus if you don't go looking for him. Herod was not looking for Jesus. Every other Jew in the country was looking for the Messiah. They were anticipating the Messiah. They were crying out for the Messiah to come. They had entire festivals asking God to send the deliverer, the Messiah. They were begging God. Herod didn't want any part of it. He wanted the status quo. He wanted things to stay the same. He was content with the way things were. For thousands of years, the Jewish people had been anticipating the arrival, the one who would deliver them permanently. Many at this time believed he was coming to free them from Roman tyranny, from the imperialism of Rome. But Herod didn't want things to change. He was happy. And if you're not searching, you're not going to find anything. Jeremiah says it this way, "You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart." So much in that verse. God makes a promise to us that we will find him if we seek him with all of our heart. It is not an if, it's not a maybe. It is a promise from God that you will seek me and find me when you seek me with all of your heart. And that conditional phrase at the end of that statement, all of your heart, is the kicker. That we have to be willing to commit everything to our pursuit of Jesus. God promised this, that we will find truth. We've got to want to find it. We've got to look with everything we've got, with all of our heart. Herod didn't seek with his heart. Herod went looking with his agenda. He wanted to find Jesus, but he wanted to find Jesus so he could execute him. He wasn't open to the truth. He only wanted to fulfill his own desires. And that describes so many people in our world today. They may want to go to church, but they have an agenda. They're looking to have their needs met. They're looking to have something happen in their own lives. They're willing to accept God, but only on their terms. They want to recreate God in their image instead of God creating us in his. There is an openness and a willingness that's inherent in a search. You have to be willing to accept what you find for what it is without having your own agenda. Some of you have been searching for God and you still haven't found him. Could it be that you have been looking for God with an agenda? You're looking for what you want to find instead of for what the objective truth of who God is. You're convinced maybe that God is vindictive, and so you find negative circumstances that you choose to attribute to God and ignore any examples of his love that you encounter. Or maybe you think God can't change anything in your life and in your circumstances, and so you're drawn to people who are following Jesus who live openly hypocritical lives and decide that it wouldn't work for you either because it's not working for them. We need to set our agenda aside. We need to set aside our thoughts and notions of who God is and go looking for truth, to be willing to accept Jesus for who he really is and to have a personal experience with him. That's what the wise men did. The wise men pursued Jesus. They weren't sure what they were going to find. They were open to the truth. They knew that someone was out there, and they set everything aside to pursue him, to find him, and they found Jesus, and they worshiped him. Every one of us has a different story of how we discovered Jesus' love for us. For some, it was as a child that we discovered God's love. Maybe it was in a church setting. Maybe our parents taught us. For some, it was as an adult. It was after a hard life of rejecting God and going the other direction that God redeemed us and he called us and we found him. For some of us, we decided to pursue God on our own. For others, circumstances drove us there. Regardless, there was a moment in time where we decided to really look, to open our eyes and see God for who he really is, to see if the claims the Bible makes and the stories the people had told us were real, and it changed everything for us. Herod never went to experience Jesus personally. He tried to figure out Jesus from a distance through other people's experiences, which leads us to the second thing today that I want us to learn, is that you'll never experience Jesus until you experience Jesus. You'll never experience Jesus until you experience Jesus. You can't send someone else to do your research in this case. It's not a group project. You know, you always had those kids in the group projects in high school where you got three or four, there's five people in the group, and three or four of them are working hard, and the one person's just like sitting back, not doing anything, not contributing. And everybody else, they want the good grade, and so they make up for it, and they do all the work, and at the end, he gets the A, just like everybody else does. And you're like, that doesn't make any sense. Why should he get the A too? Well, he was part of the group, because it was a group experience. Guys, serving God, even though we serve him collectively as a body of believers in a church structure, serving God is a personal, personal experience that you have to have with him one-on-one. Herod sent the Magi on a fact-finding mission and thought he'd get an accurate assessment of who Jesus is. Come back and report to me what you found. It doesn't work that way. You can't send your spouse to church and hope that your life is going to be changed by the experience. It doesn't work that way. It's personal. You can't pass a judgment based on what someone else has said or done. Don't ever hold Jesus accountable for the actions of his followers. Boy, is this huge. There are so many bad examples out there of Christ followers. Tons. You'll find them everywhere. There are tons of bad examples in this room of what it means to follow Jesus. Well, Pastor, isn't that kind of harsh? How do I know this? Because I'm one of them. Follow me around for 2-3 days. You will see dozens of moments where I am a pathetic example of what it means to be a follower of Jesus. I'll say the wrong thing. I'll do the wrong thing. I'll act selfishly. I'll cut somebody off in traffic. I'll lay on the horn for somebody who cut me off in traffic. I'll do things that are not good. I'll react to my kids in the wrong way. I'll snap at Melissa. I'll do things that are not appropriate for someone who says, hey, I patterned my life after him. This room is filled with bad examples of what it means to be a follower of Jesus, depending on the time and the day that somebody's following you. And so you can't hold Jesus accountable for the actions of his followers. You'll see plenty of boneheaded, self-centered choices that don't reflect Jesus well. And there's not a person in here who isn't a bad example of a Christ follower several times a week, maybe several times a day, maybe right now, I don't know. The important thing is to realize that Jesus has changed my life. You don't want to see what my life would be like without Jesus. Way worse. I'm still a work in progress, as is every single person in this room. And with that, when I blow it, here's the key. This is what's awesome. When I blow it, I'm forgiven. When I mess up, Christ has forgiven me. He has redeemed me. He has set me free, and he brings correction, and he brings growth, and he sets my feet back on the right path, and he causes me to move forward in my pursuit of him. The only way to make an accurate decision about Jesus is not to experience it through one of his followers, but to experience it with him personally. When you come face to face with Jesus, you are forced to make a decision. The decision is made through the experience. But if you never experience Jesus, you'll never be able to truly decide because you're basing your decision on only half the information. The facts aren't going to cut it. If information alone could save you, then even Herod would have been saved if all it took was information, because he had all the information. But information alone will not save you. It's not what you know, but what you do with what you know that saves you. I had a professor at the University of Illinois. I took a class called Religious Studies 101, the study of the Bible as literature. I had a gen ed requirement to fill, and I thought, hey, I'll take that one. Easy A, right? I know the Bible. So I go in there, and day one, he says, every year I get some of these fundamentalist Bible-believing Christians who insist that everything in the Bible is truth. We always have problems. I'm like, I did have problems with him several times. And that man, here's the thing, Dr. Shadle, never forget him. Dr. Shadle knew more scripture than I probably ever will in my entire life. He could quote entire chapters and books of the Bible. He knew it inside and out. If information is all it took for someone to be saved, he would have been saved 100 times over. It's not what you know. It's not the information you're given. It's what you do with the information that leads to your transformation. And he had never allowed the Holy Spirit to do a work in his heart. God is not just a concept. He's not just a collection of ideals. God is a person. Jesus isn't someone to learn about. Jesus is someone to experience. Too many people stay content with just learning about God. Don't sell yourself, or more importantly, don't sell Jesus short by just learning about him. The information has to lead to an experience. I could tell you all day long that Chicago-style deep dish pizza is the best pizza on the planet. You could listen to me describe it in great detail. You could research it. You could see that the overwhelming majority of the people agree with me. You could look into the ingredients. You could learn everything there is to know about it. But until you've tasted it, it just doesn't mean as much. Just so you know, if you're ever in Chicago, Lou Malnati's. That's all you got to know. But here's the thing. Psalm 34, verse 8 says this. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Guys, that is not an information verse. That is an experience verse. You ask somebody, hey, could you describe for me what a ripe strawberry tastes like? Tastes like a strawberry. How do I know? Because I've experienced it. Because I've had a strawberry. There's no way you can describe the taste of a strawberry to someone else because it's an experiential moment. This verse isn't informational, it's experiential. The information doesn't change us. The information leads us to the experience, and it is the experience with God that changes us. Why did Danielle get baptized today? She was baptized today because she had an experience with Jesus. And it led her to this moment of saying, I want to obey what he's told me to do. I want to take the next step in my faith journey. I want to be baptized and follow the example of Jesus. Not because it was informational, because it was experiential. We all need to have a deep experience with Jesus. So why don't we do it? Why don't we get there? More often than not, it has to do with Herod's final failure. It's because when you have an experience with God, you will never come out the other side the same person. You will be changed. And as the worship team comes back up and joins me this morning, I want to close with this final thought about Herod and what we can learn from him. You will never truly worship Jesus until you are ready to get off the throne. You cannot worship Jesus until you are ready to get off the throne. As we heard up front, Herod was terrified of losing his throne, so terrified that he was willing to kill even family to avoid the slightest risk of his losing his power. He killed everyone who threatened his position. And here's the thing, Herod thought that Jesus threatened his position, and guess what? He absolutely did. Jesus threatened Herod's position. There is no question he did. Matthew 28 says, Jesus came and told his disciples, I have been given all authority in heaven and on earth. Hebrews 1 says, the Son radiates God's own glory and expresses the very character of God, and he sustains everything by the mighty power of his command. Guys, Jesus was not only the king of the Jews, he was the king over all creation. He's the king of everything that is. Did he threaten Herod's authority? Yes. Because Jesus is all authority. The good news is that Jesus came so we could be forgiven. So we could give up the sin, the junk, the failure, and he would take it. He's already taken it to the cross. But with that, he takes everything. Not, yes, he takes our failures, but he takes our victories and our successes as well. When we make the decision to follow Jesus, we give up our place as king over our own little world, and he takes his rightful place as the Lord of our lives, and he restores us. That is the good news of the gospel. But the good news was Herod's bad news. Because you cannot worship Jesus until you're ready to get off the throne, and the throne doesn't get piecemealed out. It's all or nothing. You can't give almost everything to Jesus and call it surrender. You yield, you surrender. You can't keep one little part for yourself and say, well, I will obey God in every other area, but this, no, it's too important to me. I'm not going to give that up. It's like I tell my kids, partial obedience is total disobedience. 99% obedience is 100% disobedience. It's all or nothing. And that's not saying that God demands perfection from us. We covered that already. We talked about it. We are works in progress. But what God does expect is everything we've got. You will seek me and you will find me when you seek me with all of your heart. And that's not just a one-time effort. That's ongoing. That's our lives. Seeking God with everything we've got. He expects our best. He expects growth, that every day we become a little more like Jesus. And that's not a scary thing, because giving everything to God is the best thing we could ever do. It's the best thing I've ever done. My life is fantastic because I serve a God who loves me and wants the best for me and wants to use me to accomplish great things for his kingdom. You see, Herod didn't avoid surrendering his throne to Jesus. He didn't. He just delayed the inevitable. See, Philippians 2, Paul writes, therefore God elevated him, Jesus, to the place of highest honor and gave him the name above all other names, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Herod didn't avoid it. He may have refused, but the reality is everyone will bow. Everyone will acknowledge who Jesus is. The difference is, will we do it while we still have a choice? And God honors that choice with eternity with him in heaven. Herod had a problem with this. And reality is, so do most people today. There's a part of every one of us that rebels against this. We push back against this. For Herod, he was afraid of losing his kingship. He was paranoid, and that is an understatement. He had problems. But what is our excuse? Do we think we can do it better? Do we think we can handle our own sin? Do you think we're without our own paranoia when it comes to our relationship with God and what that could be? Jesus entered our world as one of us 2,000 years ago. God's plan for our redemption was revealed in the form of a helpless baby boy born to Mary and Joseph in an animal shelter. But that baby was a king. More than that, he was the king. And it's time for all of us to get off the throne and let the king take his place. Let's gain perspective from Herod, from his failures, from his mistakes, and see Jesus today for who he really is. Let's bow our heads all across this room. Let's get ready to pray.